Welcome to Modern Signed Books. If you're interested in what makes your favorite authors tick, then you'll love hearing what they have to say in our interviews. Learn how they got started writing, the books and authors that inspired them, and much more. Meet today's hottest authors as they discuss their lives and writing with art book specialist, Roger Nichols. And don't forget to pick up a copy of your favorite books at bjbooks.com. Here's Roger.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. You know, it takes an exceptionally talented author to step into the shoes of a beloved writer and continue his work, but that's just what Mark Greene has done with Tom Clancy's incredibly popular Jack Ryan series, and he's done so with dignity and grace. Now, he's more than qualified, starting with a degree in international relations and political science, and in his research for these novels, he's traveled to 15 countries, trained alongside military and law enforcement personnel in the use of firearms, battlefield medicine, and close-range combat tactics. So far, he's written or co-written 6 Tom Clancy novels and is also the best-selling author of 5 books in his Gray Man series. His latest Jack Ryan novel, The True Faith and Allegiance, is available December 6th. We're very delighted to welcome Mark Greene today.
Thanks for having me, Roger. I appreciate it.
Oh, great. Were you always going to be a writer?
Well, I was always going to write something. I don't know if I was going to be a professional writer. I got interested. I was a big reader and didn't study writing or anything like that, but when I was in college, I had an idea for my own thriller novel and started working on it. And I think I started on it when I was about 20, and my first book came out when I was 42. So that tells you how successful I was early going. But it wasn't that I got a whole bunch of rejection. It took me 15 years to finish something. And then from the first book that I finished, I think I finished my second one in 7 or 8 months. And within 2 or 3 years of finishing my first actual book, I was published. So it was actually getting the material out there and not writing that first thing, but writing something else and something else and something else that finally did the trick.
Now, according to Wikipedia, your father, Ed Greene, was the head of NBC affiliate WMC in Memphis and worked there for more than 50 years. Just wondering, do you think you might have picked up some communication skills from him?
Absolutely. I pick up a lot of things from him. Everything that's worked for me, I picked up from my dad, which I probably shouldn't have rejected for so long. But more than my communication skills, a lot of it had to do with just a real curiosity for the world. So he was a World War II vet, combat infantryman. And so I was really interested in World War II. I live in the South. I was interested in the Civil War just as a boy. Not really reading novels, but reading nonfiction stuff. And so I read a ton, and my dad read a ton. I have all his books now, and I've read almost all the books that he had on his shelf when he was alive. So it really instilled in me like a real curiosity. Him being involved in journalism had me, you know, watching the news all the time and you know, talking back to the TV and that sort of thing. So all those things, you know, slowly built me into what I am for sure.
But you said that you were a massive fan of Tom Clancy since Patriot Games back in 1987, and you have first editions of most of his books and have read them all. I understand you were first contacted by an editor you shared?
Yes, Tom Colgan has been my editor from the beginning of my Gray Man series, which where I first got published. And he used to be Tom Clancy's paperback editor, but then became his hardcover editor a few years before I got into the game. And Tom Clancy was looking for a new co-author, and Tom Colgan, his editor, thought of me. And I think Gray Man and On Target, my first two novels were out. I turned in Ballistic, which was the third in the series, but it hadn't been published yet. So he knew that you know, I could turn things in on time. He knew that he'd heard me talk a lot about being a Tom Clancy fan, and I would reference Clancy's stuff when talking to Tom a lot about ideas and things. So he kind of knew that raw material-wise, I looked like maybe I would be a good fit, but I actually tried out to be Tom's co-author. It was my idea. I just said, you know, let me write 25 pages, and, you know, you can get it back to Clancy's people, and it'll show that I know who everyone is in the series and all the relationships between one another and that sort of thing. And it wasn't to say, here's how Tom Clancy talks. It was more like, here's to prove that I understand the Jack Ryan canon pretty well. And I did that, and I got hired pretty soon, went to Baltimore, met Tom, and took it from there.
You've described that meeting, that first face-to-face in Baltimore, as I'm quoting you from another interview. It said, the most amazing and surreal occurrence of your life. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Yeah, I probably used other adjectives too, because I was pretty horrified. I was just very nervous about it. And I went in, and I'd been kind of warned that he could be gruff and, not to expect, too much warmth, but from the beginning, from walking in the door, we had a really good exchange, and his wife came in, and I wouldn't say, we felt like two old friends, but we talked about his books in ways that were just fun for me, that there were a few times right in the middle of it where I was having to remind myself, I'm actually talking to Tom Clancy about, Without Remorse, or one of his better books, and how it impacted me, and little nuances and ideas he had, and when he had them, and I was sitting in a chair, and he said, when I wrote Red Rabbit, the guy that I based that book on sat in that chair and talked to me for days or whatever. And so that was, that's nothing if not surreal. If he's one of my literary heroes, and to actually be sitting there in the room, and he's telling stories about hanging out with Freddie Forsyth and this and that. And I was just kind of blown away by the moment. And it's one of those, you have a few moments in your life where you can't wait for the moment to end so you can actually think about what's happening, but you're too in the moment to think about it right then.
That's a beautiful way to describe that. You must be an author or something. you started out, you worked on three books together with him, with Locked On and Threat Vector and Command Authority. How did you do the partnership there? Who did what in the partnership?
Well, from the very beginning, I was told the more that you talk about you did this and he did that, the less it becomes a Tom Clancy book, the more it becomes people reading the book, looking for clues and that sort of thing. So we don't, the day-to-day stuff, it was, emails, and he had his, we worked through our editor, and so it wasn't that much different from another collaboration I've done, but it's the Tom Clancy had these books out for 30 years with Jack Ryan, so I was working with characters that I knew very well and characters that were, I wasn't going to have do anything out of phase, and every word that I wrote had to, kind of be approved up the chain of command, and we worked on it like that. But it was the third book, Command Authority. I think literally we turned in the last bit of it about 2 weeks before he passed away.
Oh man!
So I'm glad that one, we did get that finished before he passed. But it was, I would have liked to keep doing it as a collaboration for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you started to write Support and Defend, a little nervous doing it on solo?
Yes, and less so than I would have been if
you hadn't
right
had
out
that.
Of the gate. Yeah. Absolutely. They came to me and said that they wanted to continue after Tom's death, and I thought that they probably would at some point, because these, there are a lot of stories to tell, and as new things happen in the world, I think a lot of people are curious on how Jack Ryan would handle them, And so I thought to myself, I took myself back to just being a reader and just being a Tom Clancy fan, and said, what do you think about this? And I just said, if it's someone who really loved the characters and loved the canon and did a faithful attempt at it and was a good enough writer, I would want to pick up the book and read it and at least try it out. So I signed on to do it, and they wanted to do two the following year. So signing on to do one meant signing on to do two. And so I was, he passed away in October, and I think that I was working on Support and Defend by December or January, and it came out in June. I think it came out in July of 14. And so it was very nervous. It would have been just beyond my ability to deal with if I had been hired out of the chute, having never met Tom or already had the three books out first, so that did help me a lot.
Yeah. One of the things I really think was smart of him early on is to realize that if you got Jack Ryan all the way up to present, he's not going to be going out on missions anymore, so we introduce Jack Jr., and now you have this interesting back and forth that you work very well with, this macro overview in the president's office and the micro feet on the ground actually doing stuff that you can go back and forth between. It really gives a balanced view for the whole thing.
Yeah, thank you, and I'm glad you said that, because I think it's fun to read. It's definitely fun to write, where you can see the strategic picture and the tactical picture of a situation, and at the same time. Just writing it, it was so fun as I got involved with the Tom Clancy work that you'd be working on a plot point of the story, and you'd think, well, I wonder how this would affect, you know, Navy SEALs on a ship off the coast of North Korea, and then you think, well, let's just go there and write that part. And so it became this sort of embarrassment of riches of the opportunities that you had working on the book, and with Jack Senior, you know, overseeing the strategic things, at least from the protagonist side, from the good guy side, and Jack Jr. as being the guy on the ground with the earpiece in his ear, you know, trying to tail somebody. These two things kind of coalesced into making the story fun. It's a tough sell, honestly, that the president's son is involved in this Sub Rosa intelligence organization, but with a little suspension of disbelief and a lot of work of, actual legitimate tradecraft and surveillance tactics and personal security and stuff that people who do that sort of thing for a living undergo. You know, you do your best as a writer to sell it, and then at some point you just say, you know what, the readers hopefully are having enough fun that they're not really dissecting the whole story to figure out how plausible every little bit is.
Yeah. Well, it's fascinating. You know, I always get something out of a Jack Rand novel. One thing I like about it is you always send me reference books or online or a dictionary or something, and I love the acronyms. This time it was JWICS and SCIF and TICS and TADS that I picked up, and Clean Skins, also some nicknames. And I love it that I learned the Romanian word for cool, beton, which also means concrete. I have no idea. This must be kind of a Soviet leftover thing. I like concrete.
Maybe so. Maybe so. Yeah. I have a Romanian friend who's also a computer expert, and he helped me with that sort of stuff. So that was handy. But it was also Romania has long been known for cyber crime. And in True Faith and Allegiance, I kind of wanted to sort of put cyber crime that – Malou along with cyber warfare, just kind of like weaponize information a little bit through different bad actors all up against America. So Romania was a good location to use, and it didn't hurt that I had a buddy who'd helped me on some other Clancy stuff on some other books with some technical things that was Romanian and also super helpful guy. So that made it
nice.
Fun.
Yeah. So we should, that probably leads us into talking a bit about the plot of this one, because it is a gem. I will speak that. Start off, there's this amazing scene, Commander Scott Hagen on leave, attacked by an armed man in a restaurant. He's shot. He managed to fight off the attacker. And the gunman reveals he's the Russian whose brother was killed when his submarine was destroyed by Commander Hagen's ship. And Hagen wants to know how he knew where he was, but the guy dies before that. And this sets up this whole chain of how are these other things happening. CIA agents are being unmasked. Somebody's obviously got a hold of a chunk of information. Who is it? How are they using it? Why is it happening? How are they able to find out? It is a wonderful puzzle.
Thank you very much. Yeah, to me, my initial idea of this book came from, you know, a real thing that happened. I mean, of all the books I've written, this one probably is one of the most action-packed, but it's definitely the most realistic and plausible. There's so many things in other books I've written that could happen, but this was all based on things that were actually happening and going on, and I tied things together in ways that I don't know that they're actually tied together in the real world, but, you know, they're all those little fingers of plots are going on. And the Office of Personnel Management, which, among other things, had kept on an unsecured computer all of the applications that everyone had filled out, 25 million or so people had filled out to get classified intelligence status with the U.S. government, was hacked a few years ago, actually by China in real life. In this book, it's by a corporation that does it in Romania for the purposes of cybercrime. And I was just fascinated. That was in the news a lot when it happened, but the repercussions for what that meant, that everybody that has applied for classified information, now all their personal information is in the hands of America's enemies, that blew me away and how that could be used. And I've talked to people who are, let's say, in the military or in certain three-letter agencies in the government, and they are – it's something very much at the forefront of their mind, how And if you talk to them, they'll talk about how this could potentially be used against them. So in the novel, I wanted to use a lot of different threads. It wasn't about necessarily just one bad actor, although there are, you know, some main antagonists in the book. It's that the data is out there and the potential of taking this, what should be classified data, which is out in the wind, and weaponizing it with social media information and other open source intelligence information to actually target individuals in the government who, you know, we'd rather the bad guys didn't know who they were, much less where they were having dinner tonight. And so that sort of became the initial kernel that the book grew out of. So it's a big, wide-sweeping plot, but it's all based on America not being very good at keeping its secrets.
At one point, you write that that everybody has someone in his life on social media who likes to talk. So whether you're keeping security yourself, if you're sister or a cousin or somebody says, hey, he's going to be there in this particular time, this particular place, it's out there for the internet. If somebody knows who you are, your identity, and does a search in your name, it's going to pop up. So that's scary.
Yeah, and that came to me, you know, that was actually sort of explained to me by someone who's affected by this, you know, and he's like, obviously I don't have any sort of a social media profile because I shouldn't. And he said, but, you know, if my sister-in-law talks about, you know, going to her nephew's football camp, or, you know, picking her nephew up from football camp or something like that, you know, then suddenly that sort of outs him to someone that understands who he is or whatever. Another side of that is the people who have social, you know, sort of robust social media accounts, and then they, let's say they get a job, you know, or they work in military intelligence or something like that, and they go dark on social media, or they are studying, you know, they're on social media talking about they're studying Arabic studies at Georgetown, and then they go dark when they graduate. Little things like that can be tip-offs to some people. So that's only going to get bigger and more pervasive.
Yeah, it's a fascinating setup. And the book itself is typically huge and wonderful. And I just whizzed through it just as quickly as I possibly could, because this is the thing about an author that really intrigues me is the ability to say, I've got to know what happens next. And how you do that, set up hints and get a tension point up to a point and then switch to a different locale and start building another one. I love that magic that you do.
Thank you very much. It's like making sausage. You don't necessarily want to know. It may not be created as beautifully as people, you know, think that the final product is, or hopefully they think that. There are times when I'll be reading through the manuscript late in the game, and I'll think, okay, this part seems to lag a little bit, or every now and then I'll be writing a book, and I think it happened in this one, where I felt like one of my plot lines got resolved too quickly, and it kind of like left some other intangibles out there. And when you're dealing with a Tom Clancy novel, there's a whole lot of plot lines going on that all need to sort of thread together at the right place to lead the reader, you know, to intrigue the reader, and to also sort of have those aha moments that I love as a reader. And you want them in the right place, and they have to have the right impact and all that. So there's a whole lot of, you know, you have these great vision for the book. Your book is always best when it's like in your head right before you start typing it, and you have this idea of how the book is going to feel and everything, and then at the end you have to sort of come back and cobble some things together and make some things work out better. But I'm glad if you think the final offering was good, because there is some work there at the end to get it constructed correctly.
Well, you know, it's you know, like you bake the cake, it's a little lopsided, you go in, you prop it up with a toothpick here, a little frosting there, bingo, it's wonderful. So
yeah, you're the only one that knows. I know where all the bodies are buried in my novel, that's for sure.
And speaking of things that are hidden in the stuff that I really appreciate, when you write a series, you know, things change over time, and one of the hallmarks of a good series is the acknowledgement of earlier events without, like, dwelling on them. So people who are new to the series will pass by, but those who have been with you for a long time will get that extra meaning and context. And I have an example of that. Scott Hagen, that we talked about, is introduced to the captain of the USS James Greer. Now, that's a nice touch, since Admiral James Greer was introduced back in the Hunt for Red October as the deputy director of intelligence for CIA and plays a key role in Patriot Games and dies in clear and present danger from cancer. And I discovered there was a real Rear Admiral of the U.S. Navy, James A. Greer, who served during the Civil War, and there was a real destroyer, the USS Greer, launched in 1918. So life follows art. I don't know if Mr. Clancy knew that when he wrote that originally or if that was on purpose, but I love the way that worked out. So.
Well, I wrote the James Greer was my idea to make it a destroyer, and I did know, just because I was researching destroyer names to make sure that I did know that there was a torpedo destroyer, the Greer, and I don't think I even looked to see who the actual James A. Greer was. But what happened was in Tom Clancy Commander in Chief, that ship, the guided missile destroyer Greer, plays a big part in it with
right.
Scott Hagen. And so last year, last summer, I went over to San Diego and got on board the USS Sampson, which is DDG 102, which is the designation number of the Greer uses in this book. So I got to go on board a guided missile destroyer. I changed the name of it because, you know, Jim Greer was Jack Ryan's sort of mentor in the early days of the Clancy
right.
series. So I just thought it would be kind of nice and poignant that it played this big role. But it's so funny, when that book came out, I'd say like by the spring, I was getting dozens of emails from people going, "Hey, idiot, the BDG 102 is the USS Sampson, not the Greer. You know, like, learn your stuff." And, you know, all these ugly emails from people. So I'd have to email them back. I'm going, right, I was actually on the Sampson 6 months ago, and I did know that. And it's called James Greer because there's a character going back in the Clancy series. So you very politely tell them that you're not the idiot. But it was just a poignant little nod back to the Tom Clancy series.
Right. And I don't want to give away too many plot points, but there's a little romantic tension and inter-team tension that comes as a result of some changes going on.
Yeah. The campus, which is this sub rosa off the books intelligence group that Jack Ryan Jr. works for, and John Clark, anyone that's read the Tom Clancy novels will know the CIA officer, John Clark. The campus is a very, very small unit that, for literary reasons, we have to use in a lot of different positions in mm-hmm. in these stories. And so it's just a few operators, and which makes sense for a small operation as it is. But I want to show sort of the inter-team struggles and the difficulty of keeping this operational tempo. You know, a new Clancy book comes out every year, right? And there's books in the summer as well, and sometimes they use the campus. And this operational tempo, men in the campus have died before in other books, and you want the reader to be involved in this buy-in that any one of the characters that they're reading about, something terrible could happen to them, you know, because they are being put in harm's way. So it was interesting to me, after this was my seventh book, to show that they're actually trying to vet and train up new members of the campus, and how these people fit in, the relationships between other people who are in the campus, and that sort of thing. And it's a subplot for sure, because there's a whole lot else going on in the story, but it just feels honest and realistic to me that they are trying to populate this group, which has taken some hits recently, and that's a lot of work too.
Switching direction just a moment, you have said some other interviews that you actually own many of the weapons that are used and have fired them. I've seen the amazing simulated combat video that you went through and with smoke bombs and firing automatic weapons, and it was pretty impressive. So are you a good shot?
Well, compared to who am I a good shot? Compared to thriller writers of the world, I think I'm probably pretty good. I've taken a whole bunch of courses with, you know, alongside military and SWAT and that sort of stuff, live fire firearm courses of different types at different places. And I do own, I have an AR-15, a couple of AK-47s, a whole bunch of handguns, a couple of shotguns. So I have some of the good weapons that we use in the books, and I do have a good understanding of firearms. I am a gun guy, and I always say this when I speak publicly, and anyone ever asks me a question about this. As a writer, you realize that the biggest jerks out there are gun guys. And I can say that because I am a gun guy, who will write you with the most pedantic things about a gun. You know, you'll say 75 things about a gun, which is probably 74 more than most readers need. And you'll get 73 right and get one thing wrong at, you know, the feet per second at muzzle velocity or something. You'll have it off by 15 feet a second, and somebody will write and say, you don't know anything about firearms. and you want to respond and say, well, I talked about the cyclic rate of that gun, and that was right. If I didn't know anything about firearms, how did I know that it fired 600 rounds a minute? Little things like that. So that's just one of the crosses you bear when you write novels. But I enjoy shooting, and I enjoy meeting the people. I'll stay in team rooms for a few days or even for a week. Some of these courses that I take, and you know, you meet guys in federal law enforcement, and you meet guys, even like drone pilots I've met while at shooting school, and you end up using them in your books and using them as subject matter experts. So it's a lot of fun, and hopefully something I can keep doing as I get older, but it gets a little tougher as time goes on.
And the way that I think the thing that impresses me, of course, I'm a layperson and I'm not a gun person at all because, let's face it, I'm not very talented in that department. I speak from experience here. I almost once shot my foot off. So, but what I like is the casual way that you just introduce stuff kind of in passing. You don't stop and do a 20-minute lecture on this particular gun, but you just a fact here and a fact there that shows you know your stuff. And I think that's part of the talent of an author is knowing how deep to dip into any particular area.
Well, thank you. And it's something I notice in reading a lot. It's the people that sort of show their, you know, that want to show that they have the information, as opposed to people that are using the information to kind of serve the story. And I do try to just put things in the story that are germane. And it goes beyond guns. I'll read an entire book, and at the end of the book, I think I'm doing it for research, and I realize, wow, I would love to put aspects of that book into this novel just to show people that I took the time to read this 600-page, research manual or something, but it really doesn't serve the story. So I'm pretty good at being disciplined at that because I am very much first and foremost a reader. I'm not a guy that came from Delta Force to become an author, and actually I have a friend that's a Delta Force guy that is a very good author, so that's not knocking them, but I don't come with any other main expertise other than being a huge fan of novels in this genre. So anything that doesn't really serve the story, I need to pull out of there. And sometimes it's tough. Sometimes your own ego says, you know, holy moly, you did all this scuba diving in the British Virgin Islands. You need more scuba diving scenes in there just to show that you know what you're talking about. But then you realize that, you know, there's better plot ideas that take place, above the surface than below. So you just can't really do that. So it's a tough balance.
It is, but you also have to, in the back of your mind, you're thinking, if I have it in the book, I can absolutely justify writing that whole trip off, but that may be...
Hey, we can do a whole other show on that. I'm an expert on writing things off. There's a scene in True Faith and Allegiance that takes place in Chicago, and I needed a place in the U.S., and I spent some time in Chicago this year, and I'm like, hey, that worked perfectly. The hotel I stayed in and everything is involved. It's a legitimate tax write-off for somebody who files a 1099 like I do. I'm getting a little bit into the weeds here for your piece. But it's funny, though, because I will read another novel sometimes and think, I wonder if he wrote that off. You know, that was something that he did.
You things that take place in Hawaii or Baja or someplace you can or Virgin Islands, you think maybe have that. I ran across an interesting thing you mentioned in one of your interviews, and you said that you're talking about James Grady in 6 Days of the Condor. Says he used to walk by the building and wonder what was there and made up his own story. And you said you have done that yourself.
Yeah, I did it without knowing James. I remember reading that and just thinking, wow, that was neat. Of course, he was 24 when he did it and became a best-selling author, and I was 38 and doing it and not going home and writing my great ideas. I was just sort of a daydreamer. But, you know, when you go to Washington, D.C., that's the fun of being there, is to kind of like figure out, you know, or to just let your imagination run wild. And, you know, you have to be creative to be an author. There's so many people that I talk to that are working on a book, and they have this one idea, and they work on it for so long, and I realize that was me for such a long time. I just want to take these people and shake them and go, okay, this thing that you're so in love with and you believe in so much is taking so much of your time. It's like, put it on the shelf and write something totally different just to show yourself that you can come up with these ideas, and that'll probably serve you better than putting your whole life into this one work. And it just sort of develops your creativity over time. But you have to be creative and disciplined and organized. And I had the creativity from a young age, but everything else took me forever to get together.
Oh, that's fantastic. You mentioned earlier that you had most of the first editions of Clancy. Are you a book collector as well as a reader?
I wasn't on purpose a book collector. I bought Patriot Games just in a grocery store. I was a big, I had interest in the Irish Republican Army at the time, and I saw this, picked up this novel, and everybody was talking about Clancy back then in the late 80s, or it was about 87, and I hadn't read any of them. So I bought this book because I saw it had to do with the IRA, and after that, I was just obsessed with novels. So I have a lot of first editions just because I had some authors I was just big fans of. And when their book came out, you know, I was getting it on the first day. So that's how I developed my first editions. Now, when I'm in a bookstore, I will definitely, you know, even if it's a book I've read, I'll go look for it in hardback and see if they have a used version of it and look and see what edition it is. And so I've picked up a few things like that. And I always leave a little note in my library that, you know, I bought this in 2014 just so I don't, in my old age, say, wow, I've had this book since, you know, 1982 when it came out, because that's not always the case.
Amazing stuff. We have covered a lot of ground. I do want to mention that I just received an arc of the next Gray Man series, and I hope we'll be able to talk about that when that comes out, or maybe sometime in January.
Oh, I'd love to.
All right. And also, I want to mention that if those who have been listening today, if you like these books, and who doesn't, and would like to have an autograph copy, I think they are available through this little book company that we work with.
Yeah, you should definitely pick one up there. I'm going to sign a bunch for you. I should be getting them pretty soon, I think.
All right. So VJ Books, the place you need to go for that. Mark, thanks so much for not only being a cool guy and for writing these books to continue the series on, but for taking so much time with us and being such a good guest today. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I enjoy talking to you, Roger.
Thank you for listening to Modern Sign Books. Make sure to follow and comment on who you would like to hear next. Feel free to check out our other author interviews. And visit vjbooks.com to pick up signed copies of all of your favorite books.